Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 20th day of June, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And let me start off today by noting that I didn't do a show yesterday. Your host had quite a few errands that I needed to run after a long period of not being able to do them. At least it turned out to be a beautiful day to fly. And it was a good day to take a pause as well, being kind of a slow news day, relatively speaking. And of course, since the Fed's Open Market Committee was meeting, pretty much everything economic was on hold, waiting to see what the masters of the universe would decide, or as it turns out, well, delay deciding to do. But they did telegraph what many were suggesting is probably an inevitable move anyway. Let's start there. Powell throws in the towel, says the headline from Zero Hedge. Gold, global stocks, and just about everything else have soared. The S&P is at all-time highs, as yields, of course, tumbled. Risk assets? Safe havens, it asks? Well, it doesn't matter. Just buy it all as central banks enter the last stretch of the race to the bottom. And that would mean the credibility bottom as well. What they call the global dovish tsunami, still in its jawboning phase, was started by Mario Draghi on Tuesday at the ECB and then escalated on Wednesday when Fed Chairman Powell finally threw in the towel and effectively said he would cut rates in July, which resulted in a global scramble for both risk assets, meaning things that still yield above the rate of real inflation, like some stocks, and safe havens, with global equity markets in a sea of green, and the S&P futures overnight, too, hit an all-time high. And as I began the recording today, that put most of the U.S. markets, S&P 500, Dow Jones, etc., up a little less than 1%. Dow, for example, was up over 200 points. 10-year Treasury yields, of course, plunged overnight, dropping below 2% for the first time since November of 2016 and reaching almost 1.97% before finally rebounding. And finally, they note, the ultimate safe haven assets, the real stuff, gold and silver, surged overnight. And gold finally broke out above multi-year support, as a lot of folks have been talking about breathlessly of late. And the paper versions are still up even in the crooked casinos. Gold is at this point up almost $25, about $1,385 for a still fiat ounce. That's about 1.75% rise. Same thing percentage-wise for silver, which is up just over a quarter at about $15.45 for an ounce that you probably still can't physically lay your hands on at that price. And says Zero Hedge, the rest of the world joined the party too, from the European Stoxx 600 Index, boosted by tech shares and car makers, to Asia. But, said Zero Hedge, mid-morning, at least in Europe, in a break from the global easing tsunami that swept the world over the last 48 hours, the Bank of England decided not to cut rates, and that was expected, in the unanimous 9-0 decision, causing the pound sterling to slide as, they say, the Empire's Bank sees a rising risk, that's a funny way to put it, of a no-deal Brexit. And as you know, that petrifies the European deep state. And then we have this from the World War III front. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran flared on Thursday when the Iranian Revolutionary Guard shot down an American drone that they said flew into Iranian airspace, while the U.S. says no such thing. It was over international territory, the Strait of Hormuz, the critical choke point for global oil trade, and not too far from where two oil tankers were recently attacked. Said Ali Shamkhani, Secretary General for the Supreme National Security Council in Iran, we will defend Iran's airspace and maritime boundaries with all our might. It doesn't matter which country's aircraft cross our airspace. And the IRGC's Supreme Commander said that shooting down the drone was to send a clear and strong message to the U.S. Iran's borders are red lines, and though they don't seek war, they're ready for it. The news, though, had the desired effect, at least on one front, sending oil prices surging, with Brent crude up as much as 3%. Meanwhile, the U.S. has branded the shooting an unprovoked attack and said the president has been briefed on the incident, although some of us doubt that he'll have much say-so as to what happens when it comes to real war. Certainly, if recent reports from the New York Times, for example, are any indication. The president, however, did follow up by tweeting, quote, Iran made a very big mistake. Multiple sources are claiming that geopolitical experts, whatever that means nowadays, have warned that the incident Thursday, quote, significantly raises the prospects for international conflict. And among those who would agree is Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was warned that an attack on Iran by the United States would be, quote, catastrophic, as the U.S. Navy is deploying more forces to the drone crash site. According to Reuters, Putin followed up his warning by saying that further U.S. attack would, quote, trigger a surge in violence and a possible refugee exodus. Uh-oh, folks. I wonder if Soros in San Francisco are passing out bus tickets yet. And call this next story a quick cautionary note, both at home and abroad. Courtesy of BreakingDefense.com and Zero Hedge, the U.S. Army is going to deploy soldiers, well, first at least to Afghanistan, with a brand new handheld drone. They claim it's going to have all kinds of wonderful features. The 1.16 ounce Black Hornet, developed by Prox Dynamics of Norway and acquired by U.S.-based FLIR Systems, is designed for local surveillance missions over the modern battlefield, and it looks like it could be used for, let's just say, other things as well. The tiny drone has high-tech sensors, allowing it to operate day or night. They claim it has low audio and visual signatures, so call it semi-stealth, a flight time of about 25 minutes. It's basically palm-sized and features its own promotional video. And if history is any guide, since you're hearing about it now, it probably means they've got better stuff already coming to a theater near you. Item from the continued destruction of the rule of law and replacement by a deep state mafia files. Arkansided or MS-13 assassinations? Hey, you decide. Six related Pizzagate deaths, as a piece from Dave Hodges at The Common Sense Show and Alexandra Daily, in just 72 hours. It's been long established, they begin, that cartel activity, consisting largely of their favorite big three activities, drug trafficking, child sex trafficking, and gun running, are now a hybrid model of the marriage between Middle Eastern terror groups and the South and Central American drug cartels that have long employed the violent Central American street gangs to carry out their political, media, and law enforcement assassinations. In Mexico, over the last campaign cycle, 400-plus politicians were murdered. An untold number of law enforcement officials have been assassinated, along with many of their family members. And journalists, too, killed at record rates in Mexico. And now, with the importation of fully intact family-style cartels right into America, it's only a matter of time until the same behaviors. Well, wait a minute. Who's he kidding? They've been going on for a while. Here, they're just a little bit more hidden, because if the journalists are threatened enough, they decide not to report on them. Anyway, one way or another, surface inside the United States. And yeah, Hodges goes on to say, some believe that MS-13 has already reared its ugly head and are probably very active in the political assassination game anyway. I mean, really, folks, just look at Southern California. Hodges says, when asked recently why MS-13 was being imported in such big numbers into the United States, he replied, quote, when political assassinations are planned, along with media figures and law enforcement officers, the brutal use of MS-13 can lead to a complete destabilization of our society, while keeping the CIA and Clinton Foundation hands clean in this arena. And that's a pretty good way to put it. It also, no doubt, goes a long way to explaining why you haven't seen orange jumpsuits on a whole bunch of scumbags and traitors. He notes that Alexander Daly sent him a list of 10 documented murders, alleged murder-suicides, and outright murders that seem to jump out and demonstrate the levels of criminality that the cartel terrorists are deep involved in already on this side of the border. They could have been Arkansided as well, he notes, and maybe it's some of the same people involved in both, because one way or another, each of these deaths, he says, is related to Hitlery. And of course, if you don't remember, the term Arkansided is reserved for the long list of people who posed a legal threat to the Dixie Mafia, a.k.a. the Clintons, and their organized crime activities and their continuation. Of the 10 who've been recently murdered, 6 of them were directly related to child sex trafficking, related Clinton emails to that effect, and specifically to comet Pizzagate, and all of them have died mysteriously within just a 72-hour period. As he puts it, can anyone else say the purge? So, without further ado, on to the list. Number 1, Linda Collins Smith, former Arkansas State Senator, who died of gunshot wounds and in a bizarre manner with her body wrapped in a blanket, which some suggest is symbolic of, you got it, a cover-up. Jonathan Nicole was a former Oklahoma State Senator, as was Collins Smith, who also died of a gunshot wound, and in what's called message-killing fashion, the gun was found on a table near the body. Stephen Silks, now deceased New York deputy, allegedly committed suicide by a gunshot, but he was only a month away from retirement, which does kind of raise eyebrows. He was also one of the few people who's actually seen the horrifying and graphic details on the infamous Anthony Weiner laptop. Wiener's own version of an insurance policy that literally, supposedly, made grown men cry. And these may, suggests Hodges, be some of the same emails that might have gotten Seth Rich murdered. There are 33,000 of them, of course, in the Clinton Library. Well, not really in the Clinton Library, but should have been. That various deep state and Obama-appointed judges have worked so hard to cover up as they block their release to the public. What are we up to? Number four, Joseph Calabrese, NYPD homicide detective, committed arsonicide with his own gun, and he was yet another who'd seen the infamous Pizzagate-related info on Anthony Weiner's laptop. Herb Sandler, another Pizzagater tied to the infamous Comet Pizzagate and the Podesta emails that have been kept out of the public eye. You know what, folks? I have to pause here and say, for those that are superstitious, you're probably far better off seeing what was inside Pharaoh's tomb and suffering the curse of the Pharaohs than the curse of the Clintons. And then finally, perhaps most notable member of the tragic list, Tony Rodham himself, brother of none other than Hitlery, and in a very bizarre twist of fate, the cause of his death is simply not being released. At least with Scalia, they admitted he was suicided by pillow, and then failed to do an autopsy. Says Hodges, I can't remember a higher profile death when the cause of death wasn't at least vaguely referred to. And he says it again, look, we cannot conclude that these six individuals within just a three-day period were taken out by Clinton death squads, because now that we have MS-13 in the country, there's clearly at least one more level of plausible deniability baked into the cake. And if history is any guide, as the Mexicanization of America continues, we're likely to see a lot more of these. And let's remember that when it comes to bad stuff being imported en masse across the southern border, it's not just the potential of WMDs or even MS-13 gang member WMDs, but other kinds of deadly diseases, too, that are of concern. Why, says a piece by Ethan Huff at Natural News, is the U.S. government importing and then quickly redistributing all over the country thousands of migrants from Ebola-stricken nations? He points to InfoWars' Owen Schroyer, who recently attempted to get some answers about all that, only to be forcibly removed from the makeshift processing center of so many of the migrants in San Antonio, Texas, where they're being first dropped off and then loaded into vans for shipment elsewhere all over the U.S. You know what, folks? Almost like you can see the deep state waving its finger at Trump and saying, ha ha, how are you going to find him and deport him now? But not to worry, say the welcome wagons at the disease importation centers, because Ebola has a 21-day incubation period, and these migrants, according to their own testimony, have been walking for more than 21 days, so they couldn't possibly have Ebola. Don't worry your pretty little heads about it. Which inspired Mike Adams, the much-banned head honcho at Natural News, to chime in with some very unwelcome truth on the issue, saying that either these San Antonio officials are grossly incompetent or they're outright lying. Oh, and by the way, it begs the question of how many migrants from Africa actually walked to the U.S.-Mexico border, unless they can walk on water. Because, for one, the Ebola incubation period only averages 21 days, but it can be over 40 days in some people, according to data from the World Health Organization. And furthermore, who says the carriers entering the United States had to be the ones initially infected? They could have been infected by other carriers who perished before getting here or didn't come. And infected migrants could end up entering the U.S., for example, on day 10 of their own incubation period, or maybe day 30. But by the time they begin to explode with symptoms, they've already been transported to who knows where, any of the dozens of U.S. cities currently receiving the time bombs. And surely, he notes, doctors had better know that magically declaring zero risk among people who come from a region of the world that's known for producing symptomless carriers of Ebola isn't at all a valid conclusion. So they're putting all of America at risk for political purposes. Or worse. This, folks, is a story about which you can pretty much guarantee we're going to eventually hear a whole lot more. Here next, a brief review of a story that I've referenced but actually haven't done, simply because, quite frankly, folks, there's more BS in here than there is news. Fake news, if you will. In no small measure because it comes from none other than the New York Times. Their headline says, U.S. escalates online attacks on Russia's power grid. And it quotes so-called current and former government officials to say that the United States is stepping up its ongoing digital incursions into Russia's electric power grid as a warning to President Vladimir Putin and a demonstration of how the Trump administration, sick, is using new authorities to deploy cyber tools more aggressively. Here comes a bit of what I generally refer to as the 80-20 rule, folks. A little truth, or maybe sometimes more than a little, but mixed with a lot of falsehood as well, in a ratio of 80%, 20%, and decide yourself which one is which. In interviews, it says over the past 3 months, officials described the previously unreported deployment of American computer code into Russia's grid and other targets as a classified companion to more publicly discussed action directed at Moscow's, did you catch that? Moscow's disinformation and hacking units around the 2018 midterm elections. Of greater concern to those of us that have been paying attention is the other hacking done by the likes of Gulag to Facebook and, of course, direct voter fraud and software manipulation of the easily manipulated, or so it seems, electronic voting machines that sadly allow all kinds of really disreputable stuff to happen and outright theft of elections, witness more than a few during the 2018 midterms. And the fact that the socialist media giants don't call it hacking, they have other terms like shadow banning, search algorithm tweaking, you know, to display only the results that they want you to see in the order and intensity that they want you to see them, does not mean that they're not hacking elections far more effectively and certainly covertly than Russia even tried to. So back to the propaganda and the 80-20 rule. Advocates of a more aggressive strategy now say it was long overdue after years of public warnings from the Department of Octung, Homeland Security, and the FBI. Certainly not about the election rigging they've been getting away with, but the fact that Russia has inserted malware that could sabotage American power plants, oil and gas pipelines, or water supplies in any future conflict with the United States. And here's the part that they really don't want to talk about, folks. In some cases, have no doubt that they were using back doors put in there by those very same agencies and others, or at least at their behest with their public-private partners. You deliberately make the systems vulnerable, and all kinds of disreputable criminals, including the ones that ordered it, can then get in. Yes, they say, and this is for sure true, power grids have been a low-intensity battleground for years. Now, what's interesting in the piece, and what's attracted the attention, is the fact that two administration officials said they believed Mr. Trump, hey, who is he anyway, had not been briefed in any detail about the steps to place the implants, the software code, inside the Russian power grid. Pentagon and intelligence officials describe broad hesitation to go into detail with the man who thinks he's president and commander-in-chief about operations against Russia because they were concerned about his reaction. Are you ready for this? The possibility that he might countermand it or say, for crying out loud, quit doing that, or even discuss it with foreign officials, as they say he did back in 2017 when he mentioned a sensitive operation in Syria to the Russian foreign minister. Well, you know, the president's problem is he was elected to try to avoid things like World War III. And maybe this shouldn't come as any surprise. Shortly thereafter, the president lashed out at the New York Times, saying they'd engaged in a, quote, virtual act of treason for that story that said the U.S. was ramping up its cyber intrusions into Russia's power grid. Which, if you think about it, folks, is true whether the story itself is true or not, because at the very least, it undermines national security and presidential authority. Perhaps because of comments like this one, this comes as the U.S. looks for new ways to punish Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election and prevent a recurrence. And yeah, we know what that means. The Gray Lady, in its official public relations account, called the presidential accusation dangerous and said it had told officials about the story before it was published, just not the president, and no security issues were raised. In a pair of tweets sent out over the weekend, President Trump asserted the story wasn't true and denounced the reporters as cowards, saying, quote, do you believe that the failing New York Times just did a story stating that the United States is substantially increasing cyber attacks on Russia? This is a virtual act of treason by a once great paper, so desperate for a story, any story, even if bad for our country, he wrote. And he followed that up by saying that not only were some other things they said lies, but they're, quote, true cowards and without doubt, the enemy of the people. And from there, I move on to another piece, Ponder the Irony, from, of all places, the left-leaning Bloomberg, which is finally admitting in an op-ed by David Fickling that, quote, cyber attacks make smart grids look pretty dumb, which is something your electronic engineer host has been saying for a long, long time. But at least some of the left is finally figuring it out. Maybe now that the back doors are such a vulnerability that they can no longer be ignored. Oh, and also the fact that for the most part it's probably too late to do much about it. Here's how Fickling kicks it off. Imagine if your thermostat led to a region-wide power blackout. It's a scenario, they say, that's looking increasingly plausible, some would say even probable. Argentina isn't ruling out a cyber attack as the possible cause for the mass outage there that affected millions of people in 5 South American countries over the weekend. And even if that incident turns out to have a more innocent explanation, and don't count on it, folks, at least don't count on believing whatever it is you're told. The U.S. government is stepping up digital incursions into Russia's power grid, yes, as none other than the reliable New York Times reported over the weekend, citing unnamed officials. And the growing threat, they say, from hacking is somewhat inevitable, given the way our power systems are changing. Yes, the power grids have generally been highly centralized, but the spread of smart metering and automated control systems has now changed even that landscape, with more than 10% of global grid investments, some $30 billion a year or so, now dedicated to digital network infrastructure. And the grids of the near future are likely to be increasingly decentralized, and that's a probable misnomer, folks. Not only an oversimplification, but certainly approaching a technical falsehood anyway. Because while the idea of the things they mention here, like domestic refrigerators, air conditioners, and industrial facilities that are compensated for switching off their power during demand peaks, while other things like vehicle chargers soak up the excess when it's available, to call those decentralized is a gross oversimplification. Do they get software updates from a central source? Can they be given orders from the power grid? Or can they ultimately just be hacked or otherwise centrally controlled? You betcha. And the problem here, says Fickling, is the vast amount of infrastructure, think 5G folks, and there's more to it than that, needed to support such a setup. Any smart electrical grid, Bloomberg admits, needs a parallel telecommunications network to work and collect and harness the volumes of data that it'll generate, and that makes every connected thermostat or smart refrigerator or you name it, down to your TV, baby monitor, and toaster oven, a potential entry point for cyber intruders. And the sleep-depriving smart meters that they're foisting on a gullible public may be the worst culprits of all. About 588 million of the blankety-blankin' things, that's your host term there, will be installed worldwide by 2022, according to a report last year by Global Data UK Limited Consultants. And once you include other connected devices and even grid operators' own control systems, that's still only the tip of the iceberg. Why, Stuxnet, that worm that crippled Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities back in 2010, appears to have been spread initially via an infected USB drive smuggled into one of the plants and plugged into a computer. Faced with an ever-growing and diversifying list of weak spots, industrial companies, says the piece, are only slowly waking up to the scale of the risk. And here, folks, I'll skip over some of the happy talk because, quite frankly, I don't buy it. But in spite of all of that, the piece admits, it still might not be enough. For one thing, they say, malicious hacks of electrical grids are far more likely to emerge from sophisticated state actors. Yeah, think three-letter agencies, who are better at covering their tracks and even blaming other state actors for those attacks and then lying low for years after they launch one. And for another, he correctly concludes, the cost of leaving a door open, especially a back door, folks, could be far greater. A hack of an internet company or credit card database might compromise personal information, but as the 2015 attack on the Ukrainian power grid demonstrated, electrical network inclusions could leave hundreds of thousands or far more folks without power for hours or for far longer. Our lives, he says, are dependent on such utility systems operating in the background, cleanly and without incident. But the latest reminder from South America is an indication of our vulnerability in a far more uncertain world. And he doesn't say it, but your host needs to, again. And it's a word to the wise as well. And furthermore, the fact that it's higher profile and from further and further left-leaning sources is another indication that we're probably getting a lot closer to where it's really going to matter. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.